Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
The man looked out at the clear blue waters of the sea. The waves lapped gently under the white sands, slapping at the wooden timbers of the two ships grounded on the beach. He nodded in satisfaction and muttered to himself, turning thoughts over in his head. This really was a perfect spot, just as the sailors had told him back home in the Greek city of Corinth. The cove on the other side of the jutting headland offered a protected anchorage for larger vessels and a convenient river just to its south. There was a freshwater spring just up from the beach, a place that passing ships often used to take on water for the next leg of their long voyage to the metal-rich land of the Etruscans. A broad, flat plain stretched out inland. Its dark volcanic soil offered the promise of rich harvests to come. He could picture it all, the neat rectangular blocks of land laid out with stakes, parceled out to the 100 people who had made the journey here to Sicily with him, growing first into houses, then temples and marketplaces, all of it surrounded by city walls, the bustling beach jammed with sea traffic. Yes, he thought, this was perfect. He would found this settlement, complete with a shrine to Apollo Archegetes, Apollo the founder, on this very spot where they had first landed. People would remember him as a great Oikistes, the heroic founder of this newborn city, his name spoken of with reverence for generations. Back in Corinth, he had lost out to his cousin. Here, he would be a man to be reckoned with. Shouts and yells snapped him out of his reverie. A man and woman, a husband and wife from the island of Euboea, were arguing about something down by the ships. Between the distance and their thick dialect, different from his own, he couldn't quite make out what they were saying. More people were gathering around them, watching the confrontation. Another man, who from his accent hailed from Naxos in the islands, was standing next to the woman, jabbing his finger into her husband's chest. That looked like trouble, the Oikistes thought. She had come to prefer this man's company to that of her husband during the voyage, the leader had heard, and the husband had been none the wiser. Clearly, that had changed. The husband drew an iron-bladed knife and slashed wildly, cursing and shouting, missing his two targets completely, but taking a chunk out of a bystander's ear on the backswing. That woman howled in pain, clutching her bleeding ear. Her husband, a burly, bearded Phoenician shipwright, ignored the Oikistes as he yelled for calm, running down toward the altercation as fast as he could. The Phoenician grabbed the offending knife-wielder's neck with one massive paw and slammed his head once, twice, then three times into the timbers of the ship with a sickeningly final thud. The Oikist, the would-be founder, sighed heavily as he looked down at the husband. He couldn't see the man's face, but then again, he didn't want to. There probably wasn't much left to examine. That was that, at least. At least the new widow had her second husband lined up, and the dead man had been a common farmer rather than a specialist craftsman. They couldn't afford to lose the Phoenician. Was this a good omen or a bad one, the Oikist wondered. Had Apollo Archegetes cursed their new settlement from the beginning, or was the loss of an unimportant colonist the price to be paid for future success? Only time would tell. The Oikist told them to move the body out of the way, told the Phoenician he'd have to offer a sacrifice to assuage Apollo Archegetes, and went back to his reverie. Yes, he thought, that was where the altar would go. There, the market. It would be a fine sight. Starting in the middle of the 8th century BC, the Greeks began to leave their homeland behind, setting up a profusion of new colonies in the central Mediterranean. Sicily was their major target, and the island soon sprouted dozens of cities, all of them just as Greek as Greece itself.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks so much for being here with me today. The Greeks, we're often told, lie at the root of a great many of the defining features of the modern world. Democracy, philosophy, myths, and much more all owe a debt to the products of the ancient Greek world, either directly or mediated through their classical neighbors and successors, the Romans. Now, of course, the real story is much more complicated and open to questions and critique. The path by which the Greeks came to occupy this foundational position in quote-unquote Western civilization is a winding and interesting one that says more about what's happened over the past 25 centuries than it really does about the ancient Greeks themselves. The Greeks were just one group in the ancient world. Much of what we often assume makes them special wasn't theirs alone, and what mattered at the time often bears little resemblance to what later commentators on the Greeks valued and emphasized. But wherever we stand on these questions of future impact, there is no doubt that the ancient Greeks created a fascinating and dynamic world. They built a profusion of populous and sophisticated cities, experimented with different political forms, built innovative and productive economies, and produced enduring monuments of architectural, artistic, and literary brilliance. This Greek world stretched far beyond the limited confines of Greece itself to encompass Sicily, southern Italy, the coast of Anatolia, the Black Sea, and the coasts of Libya and the western Mediterranean. All of that was centuries before Alexander the Great marched his armies across Asia and created an even larger Hellenistic world, the direct descendant of the Greek world that had come before. As we discussed in our last episode on Archaic Greece, nothing about it looked particularly promising after the end of the Bronze Age. The population had declined dramatically following the fall of the Mycenaean palaces. The old system of writing, Linear B, was no longer in use. There were no cities, and no settlement had a population of more than perhaps 1,500 people. The economy was far simpler than it had been. Early Iron Age Greece wasn't disconnected from the rest of the Mediterranean world. Contacts with Cyprus and the Levant, including Phoenicia, had never entirely disappeared. But it was something of a backwater, and nobody surveying the Mediterranean and its environs around 800 BC would have thought that Greece would become a land of glittering, populous cities within just a couple of centuries. This happened with shocking speed. Just a century later, by 700 BC, the outlines of the Greek world to come were already in place. They were still vague and shadowy, but it's possible to see the future path in a way that had been completely impossible a century prior. New cities had started to come into being, fused together from the profusion of villages scattered across the landscape. The economy was growing more sophisticated, and most important, the population was exploding in numbers. There may have been twice as many people living in Greece in 700 as there had been just 100 years before. That was where we left things last time, with an archaic Greece sitting right on the cusp of a tremendous expansion. Today, we're going to follow that expansion outward from the mainland and trace the outlines of the emerging Greek world over the next century or so. In 700 BC, Greek traders were active across the Mediterranean. Greek trade goods were beginning to appear well away from Greece itself, and the first Greek colonies had been established in Sicily. 100 years after that, in 600 BC, Greek trade goods were ubiquitous across the Mediterranean world. Greek cities spread across Sicily and southern Italy. Other colonies had been founded in the Black Sea, North Africa, and even the western Mediterranean. Back in the homeland, the economy had continued to grow and grow, while cities became larger, more monumental in appearance, and more politically sophisticated. The Greek world was also becoming a more competitive and warlike place, and cities regularly fought each other for territory and prestige. The Greek script with which we're so familiar was adopted far and wide, and used for everything from business and administration to literature, such as the works of Homer and Hesiod. By 600 BC, the Greek world was well on its way to becoming the place we recognize from the classical period that followed. It's essential to understand that developments in Greece and in the Greek world beyond Greece itself went hand in hand. That's why this age was such a dynamic and transformative time in both dimensions. Greek colonies such as Syracuse or Croton or Cumae were no less Greek than Athens, Sparta, and Corinth. Striking amounts of traffic passed between these ports, and they were ports, that's important to remember, bringing trade goods, people, and ideas all across this densely connected web. The 7th century BC was the key age for the development of the institutions that made up the polis, the Greek city-state. It wasn't a coincidence that happened at a time when the Greeks were increasingly going abroad to found new cities. The Greek economy in Greece itself flourished. It wasn't a coincidence that happened when Greeks were creating new markets for their goods in newly founded cities and the hinterlands those cities allowed them to access. All of these things were connected, and we have to bear that in mind as we think about them. Greece and the extended Greek world aren't separable in any meaningful way. In fact, there's a great argument to be made that the Greek portions of the central Mediterranean, such as southern Italy, Sicily, and parts of North Africa, should just be included under the label of Greece itself in this period. So let's start by talking about the roots of this overseas movement. It was a massive, pervasive, and long-lived phenomenon. Between the late 8th and 6th centuries BC, Greeks founded somewhere in the range of 500 colonies. Tens of thousands of Greeks left their homeland behind to settle permanently overseas, and many more lived abroad in these places for years before eventually returning home. That's leaving aside the even greater number of temporary voyages, particularly for trade, that brought Greeks into the wider world. So far as we can tell, in the absence of textual material, it was indeed trade that first introduced Greeks to what lay beyond Greece itself. Those overseas connections, so heightened and important in the Late Bronze Age, were never fully extinguished in the rather less prosperous centuries that followed. Greek proto-geometric pottery appeared in the earliest layers of Phoenician activity in the western Mediterranean at places like Utica in North Africa and Huelva in Spain, all the way back at the end of the 9th century BC. It stands to reason that there were probably some Greeks involved in these long-distance ventures, particularly people from the island of Euboea in western Greece. In fact, Euboea seems to have been the earliest hub of Greek overseas activity, at least that we can see in the archaeological record. That makes a great deal of sense. Euboea was home to the settlement of Lefkondi, probably the largest one in Greece at that time. Lefkondi was already closely tied to Phoenicia in the 10th and 9th centuries BC, and seems to have been one node in a network that also included the island of Cyprus and cities like Sidon and Tyre. When the Phoenicians began to head further to the west, sending expeditions to Sardinia, North Africa, and Iberia, there were probably Greeks among the crew. That would explain the presence of Euboean pottery in those early Phoenician finds. If nothing else, we can see how information about what was present in the west would have reached Greece. Information is essential if we want to understand migration, because migration is not a random act. Practically nobody heads off into the unknown simply hoping to get lucky and find a good place to live. In the vast majority of cases, migrants choose their destinations carefully. They're usually preceded by traders or itinerant explorers. Those are the people who then relay the necessary information about the availability of land, economic opportunities, and the friendliness, or not, of the people already living there. Our first traces of Greek overseas trade are pretty scattered and hard to interpret. They don't really amount to a pattern of regular commerce with places to the west of Greece. It looks more like individual Greek merchants, or even just Phoenician or Cypriot merchants with close ties to Euboea, selling Greek goods that they thought would appeal to people in the western Mediterranean. The first real sign we see of a full-blown overseas settlement with Greeks as a substantial portion of the population, dating from around 750 BC, is the island site of Pithecusae on modern Ischia in the Bay of Naples. Pithecusae is often called a Greek colony, or even a specifically Euboean colony. That's because a later text tells us that the founders of Pithecusae were Greeks from Euboea. There were obviously a lot of Greeks living there, because archaeologists have found a great deal of Greek pottery, and people buried in line with Greek rites, things like that. But those Greeks were not alone. The extensive excavations at Pithecusae have found Euboean pottery, but it wasn't the dominant form of Greek pottery. That honor actually goes to Proto-Corinthian pottery, inspired by models from the opposite side of Greece. Phoenician pottery is also incredibly common. The metal objects found in burials at Pithecusae were either imported from the Italian mainland or were made in the settlement based on native forms. The archaeologist Leva Donnellan points out that even when scholars acknowledge that Pithecusae was a mixed settlement from the beginning, they tend to treat Phoenicians as itinerant merchants, Italians as subordinates or marriage partners acquired by the male settlers, and Greeks as the key founders. Because, after all, the Greeks were going to be doing a lot of colonizing in the next few centuries. But when we look at the earliest archaeological layers at Pithecusae, we find a much more intriguing picture. The burials are much more in line with Italian practices on the mainland. The Greek pottery was locally made, inspired by Corinthian models rather than being imported Euboean ware. The locally produced amphorae were based on Phoenician models, and the seals and scarabs found in the tombs were clearly more in line with Phoenician than Euboean styles. There is absolutely no good reason to think that Pithecusae, supposedly the earliest Greek foundation in the Western Mediterranean, was actually, at the beginning, a Greek settlement at all. It was clearly a place with increasingly intense contact with Greece. Greek pottery styles and modes of wine consumption were becoming popular there, but Pithecusae looks like it was originally a native settlement with Phoenician ties. Only over the subsequent decades did Pithecusae really become Greek, thanks to a massive influx of migrants. That did happen, but the contrast between what the texts say, that Pithecusae was straightforwardly a Euboean foundation, and the material reality, which tells a much less straightforward story about different groups interacting, well, all of that should give us some hints into the messiness of Greek colonization. Whatever the texts tell us about Greeks heading out into the unknown to bravely found new cities in an empty landscape, that wasn't the reality.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Pithecusae was a commercial settlement from its inception, what is often called an emporion when founded by Greeks. The messy, multi-ethnic reality of Pithecusae's foundation that we see in the material evidence, as opposed to the clean Euboean origins the textual record provides, should be a warning to us about the stories we read, not just about Pithecusae, but about all the Greek colonies. The eminent historian and archaeologist Robin Osborne, who wrote a really solid history of the Archaic period, talks a great deal about the nature of these foundation traditions. They were only written down centuries after the events they're supposed to describe, and far from being factual records of something that happened, we should view them as stories that particular groups of people told at particular times in the future for particular reasons that made sense at that later time. In the cases where multiple versions of these stories survive, they often don't agree with each other about who was involved in the foundation, why they went, or when it happened. And very rarely do the written traditions actually match up to the earliest archaeological evidence from any of these sites. Far from being an exception to the rule simply because it was the earliest one, the messiness around Pithecusae's origins was typical of the new Greek settlements that began to pop up in the Western Mediterranean in the 8th century BC. The fact that Greeks later portrayed their foundations in these ways doesn't necessarily mean that had much of anything to do with the reality at that time. For a parallel, let's think about the stories Americans tell about the earliest European settlements and what would become the eastern United States. We have the Pilgrims, the Mayflower and Plymouth Rock, the First Thanksgiving, maybe John Smith and Pocahontas, things of that nature. Leaving aside the questionable historicity of the events mentioned in the stories, John Smith, for example, was well known as a fabulist, they don't amount to anything like a comprehensive history of early English colonization of North America. The Pilgrims were few in number even in what became the Massachusetts Bay Colony, let alone North America as a whole. They were vastly outnumbered by the Puritan colonists who arrived over the next couple of decades. Jamestown was a horror show that depended on a consistent flow of new arrivals to make up for the deaths, and Virginia changed dramatically as aristocrats, indentured servants, and enslaved people arrived over the course of the 17th century. That's without getting into the two very different other streams of English migrants that arrived in the Americas before the middle of the 18th century. The demographics, culture, and actual process of settlement in the early colonies is in no way reflected in the most common stories Americans tell about what happened centuries in the past. Americans tell those stories rather than one about cannibalism at Jamestown or King Philip's War because the ideas contained in them resonated with the retellers and the alternatives did not. That is the nature of tradition. Traditions may contain little nuggets of factual information. There really were pilgrims in a Mayflower in 1620. But whether those individual nuggets were actually representative of the broader reality and what was left out to make room for those nuggets, all of that is open to question. That is just as true when we're talking about the Greeks and their process of colonization as it is with colonial America. So far as we know right now, Pithecusi was the earliest settlement overseas in which large numbers of Greeks migrated to live, even if it wasn't founded by Greeks. It was the beginning of a massive exodus that lasted for centuries. But rather than just jumping in, we have to ask some questions to get our bearings. Picking up and moving hundreds of miles across the sea to start a new life elsewhere is not an obvious thing to do, either in the present or 2,700-ish years ago. It is a conscious choice that requires explanation, as do the choices of particular places and the decision to set up one's new home in particular ways. Why did so many Greeks choose to do this over such a long period of time and such a massive span of territory? Moreover, as we've discussed, Greeks weren't the only people doing precisely this in the Mediterranean in the 8th century BC. So were Phoenicians. That was not a coincidence. But exactly how are the activities of those two groups related to one another and how did they differ? So for a long time, scholars saw Greek and Phoenician colonization as very different phenomena. The Phoenicians, the reasoning went, were merchants first and settlers an extremely distant second. The settlements they built were trading posts that offered proximity and easy access to key goods, particularly metals. Hence we have Gades, Cadiz in southern Spain, or Kition in Cyprus. Founding cities as anything other than mercantile centers and filling up the surrounding countryside with farms, well, that was a long way down the list of priorities. Now, the Greeks, by contrast, wanted good arable farmland, and their cities were meant to be the purpose-built centers of new polities. Sure, they were interested in trade as well, but primarily the Greek diaspora left Greece to find the land that was growing scarcer at home and to build a good city in which to live the way Greeks were supposed to live. The primary term the ancient Greeks used for these colonies, apoikia, reflects this. Apoikia means something like home away from home. According to this line of reasoning, overpopulation and land hunger were the primary causes of the Greek colonization movement. The Phoenicians, by contrast, were engaged in a fundamentally commercial diaspora. They founded emporia, trading stations, places like Pithecusi would have been at its very beginning. While the Greeks sometimes did this, emporia were exceptions to the norm. They were dependent communities focused on trade, and they were ethnically mixed, rather than representing a coherent stream of migration from the Greek homeland. At least, this has for a long time been the usual way of approaching these two contemporary strands of activity. This isn't baseless. The Greek texts we have often emphasize land hunger as the major cause of the founders wanting to create a new settlement. The commercial orientation of Phoenician activity is pretty obvious from the archaeological material. In recent decades, though, the lines between Greek and Phoenician colonial activities have gotten a lot blurrier. The shortcomings of the Greek texts are clearer. The people who wrote them were much more concerned with agriculture than with trade. That was a reflection of their concerns, not archaic Greek migrants' lack of interest in trade. The archaeological evidence shows that in practically every area in which the Greeks eventually established colonies, commercial contacts preceded settlement and went along with it after the settlements grew and matured. Conversely, the Phoenicians were perfectly happy to found settlements that were primarily agricultural, not just trading posts or industrial operations. Several of them have been found and excavated in southern Spain, and they are basically contemporary with the better-known commercial settlements like Cadiz. Craft production, industry, and exchange all went hand in hand with agriculture. They weren't separate from it. Agricultural goods of all kinds, including wine and even bulk grains, were traded on an increasingly large scale during this period. Those products needed containers like clay amphorae or more perishable forms of storage that were often made right there. So when we think of these two different strands of colonization, we really shouldn't be thinking of Phoenician traders and Greek farmers as our archetypes. there were a lot of different things going on in the foundations of all these places, Greek and Phoenician alike. The stories the texts tell about the beginnings of these places tend to follow a pattern. The home city experiences some kind of crisis. It might be a collective one, such as a drought, or it could be personal, in which an important person suffers a political setback and is forced into exile. The key founder, called an oikistes, or oikist, then consults the oracle at Delphi, which tells him, almost always him, where to go to found a colony. The place is usually, but not always, depicted as being empty. Off they go, sometimes they meet the locals, who might be friendly collaborators, or they might have their land taken. The oikist founds the colony, distributes the land, establishes the bases of religious and political order, and the colony thrives, becoming an important new city in its own right. The founding oikist becomes the symbolic hero of the city, often with a fancy tomb that serves as the symbolic center of the place and a focus for its new identity. So, how far should we trust these stories? Even among the specialist scholars actively working on the Greek diaspora of the Archaic period, there's a great deal of disagreement. Some view the stories as basically nonsense. The events in question either never happened at all, or they weren't important in terms of understanding how these places came into being and grew. From this perspective, migration was a process, not an event, and foundation stories were just that, stories. The alternative perspective sees the stories as a reflection of at least a general, if not a specific, reality. The social tensions in the newborn Greek cities of this period in Greece had to have been substantial. These were booming places, populations were rising dramatically. New buildings were being constructed, new overseas trade routes forged, fortunes made and lost, political institutions were being created and fought over by the would-be power brokers of these regions. All that was a recipe for trouble. Local bigwigs must have competed and even fought one another for prestige and power. Disagreements over land, the use of resources, and what direction the community should take had to have been common. When somebody lost or got fed up, migration was a perfect way of releasing the buildup of social pressure. Send off your 100 or 200 most ambitious and potentially troublesome people to a new spot far away, and let that would-be bigwig, the oikist, be in charge of something that won't threaten the order of things at home. Everybody got a chance for upward mobility, available land, commercial wealth, and the home city gained a valuable connection, even if it didn't actually control the new foundation in the way an early modern European colony did. I think that in general terms, there is probably some truth to all of that. Core groups of migrants, probably with a leader, did come from individual cities back home, and their home city may have played an active role in assembling them to get them out. The earliest migrants to a place can have a massively outsized impact on the culture, institutions, and traditions of their new home. Later migrants tend to assimilate to established values and norms rather than overthrowing them. That's why Louisiana still has a distinct culinary tradition, public education is still so important in Puritan-founded New England, and why New York's capitalist ethos still echoes that of the commercially oriented Dutch. But it seems clear from the archaeological evidence that even at the very beginning, this moment of supposed homogeneity and a single origin, the Greek stories are a wildly oversimplified or papered-over version of reality. Even the first groups of settlers included Greeks of various origins, and that's leaving aside the indigenous peoples and Phoenicians they encountered. That's why Pithecusae is such an important case. It was the first, and we can see both the deceptive textual record of a single Euboean founding and the archaeological record of an existing Phoenician/indigenous settlement that only became Greek thanks to a later influx of migrants. What happened at Pithecusae wasn't exactly typical, but it wasn't atypical either. The stories that people tell, especially foundation stories, leave out far more than they include.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
So what did the actual process of Greek colonization look like? We have a good sense that Pithecusae was the first substantial settlement in the central Mediterranean. Based on finds of Greek pottery, it seems that Greek merchants or merchants dealing in Greek-made goods had arrived in the Tyrrhenian Sea a couple of decades before that. Other Greeks had participated in the Phoenician trade further west in Sardinia, North Africa, and Iberia. In terms of permanent settlements, however, the Greeks soon turned their attention toward the large island of Sicily. Sicily, particularly the eastern half of the island, would soon become one of the major core areas of the Greek world. The city of Syracuse would soon rival any in Greece itself in population, wealth, and prestige. One of the interesting conundrums of this period is the fact that both the Greeks and the Phoenicians eventually built large numbers of colonies all across Sicily, but unlike in Italy, Sardinia, and Iberia, there is next to no evidence for a substantial Greek or Phoenician presence before they started to build those colonies. Greek and Phoenician traders obviously knew about the island. Those headed for the Bay of Naples and metal-rich Etruria would have passed through the Straits of Messina, the narrow passage between Sicily and the toe of the Italian boot. Ships bound for Carthage or Utica in North Africa, Sardinia, or Iberia would have skirted the southern and western edges of the island on those voyages. They must have stopped off for water and provisions or to escape bad weather, and Sicily already had inhabitants. The archaeological traces of those contacts are pretty sparse, though, and the current evidence indicates that the Phoenicians and Greeks simply weren't that interested in Sicily at first. Sardinia, Iberia, and Etruria had valuable metals. Sicily was rich in minerals as well, but its inhabitants weren't especially interested in mining them for trade and export, at least not at that stage. The first new arrivals to Sicily in the Iron Age weren't actually Greeks or Phoenicians at all. They were probably Calabrians, speakers of an Indo-European and probably Italic language from southern Italy, who crossed the narrow straits to settle mostly in the eastern parts of the island. These people, known as Sicels, joined several other groups already resident on Sicily, including the probably Indo-European-speaking Elymians and the Sicani, who probably spoke a non-Indo-European language. These are all somewhat vague ethnic categories that come down to us from later and mostly Greek texts, and how they map onto the archaeology of the island isn't entirely clear. What's obvious, however, is that there were already people living in Sicily, and that both Phoenicians and Greeks were inserting themselves into a populated landscape. Populated doesn't mean full, though. The surveys of Sicily have shown pretty conclusively that there were fewer people living on the island in the early Iron Age than there had been in the late Bronze Age. Less land was under cultivation, fewer but larger settlements dotted the landscape, and there was more open space between those settlements. Those settlements also seem to have been more oriented toward the interior, leaving long stretches of valuable coastline without many inhabitants at all. That helps to explain the arrival of both Phoenician and Greek colonists. There were people, but they weren't necessarily in the places that the Greeks and Phoenicians wanted to live, and there weren't necessarily enough of them to drive off the new arrivals, even if they had wanted to. The Phoenicians began founding settlements on Sicily a little bit before the Greeks. The dating isn't entirely clear, but the significant colonies of Motia and Panormus under present-day Palermo had certainly been established by the end of the 8th century BC and probably a few decades before that. It wouldn't be surprising if they were contemporary with the Phoenician presence in the earliest layers of Pithecusae dating to no later than 750 BC. The Greeks started to arrive in Sicily in the 730s BC, if the textual record is to be believed. They gravitated toward different areas and different kinds of sites than the Phoenicians. Motia is an offshore island sitting in a protected harbor off Sicily's west coast, while Panormus, called Sis, flower, by the Phoenicians, occupied a fine natural harbor in the northwest. Motia was a straight shot across the Gulf of Tunis from Carthage, while Panormus offered direct access to Etruria to the north and Sardinia to the west, both just a few days' sail away. The Greeks, by contrast, went for the eastern coast of Sicily. They preferred sites with access to large amounts of good agricultural land. Within a really brief period, a whole string of new settlements dotted the entire length of the east coast, from Zancle on the Straits of Messina in the north to Syracuse in the far south. Again, if the texts are to be believed, this happened really quickly. Naxos in the north was supposed to have been first in 735 BC, followed by Syracuse in 734 BC, Leontinoi in 729 BC, and then Catane, modern Catania, in the middle, Megara Hiblea just to the north of Syracuse, and Zancle all the way in the far north. The archaeological material is broadly consistent with the textual record. Pottery clearly dating to the last quarter of the 8th century BC has been found in the earliest layers of excavated settlements, so while we might quibble with the exact dates, there's no real reason to doubt the general chronology. Whether the texts are as reliable about the specific circumstances of foundation is less clear. They consistently name an oikist as the leader of the foundation, and the texts also consistently define the home cities of the early colonists. Corinth for Syracuse, for example, and Naxos in the Cyclades Islands for the Sicilian Naxos. The reality of the colonists' origins was more mixed. That's something the texts occasionally acknowledge, and Euboean pottery has been found in the earliest layers at supposedly Corinthian Syracuse. We need not imagine that these were particularly large-scale ventures. The earliest layers of these sites, however much they were affected by later building and occupation, are all pretty humble. But they were ambitious. In practically every case, we see a regular town plan of houses and other features, laid out in an orthogonal fashion along the contours of the natural landscape. These plans were divided into regular rectangular blocks separated by streets, which were often paved. In a few cases, we even know how big the blocks were. At Megara Hiblaea, for example, they were 25 meters, 82 feet wide, and about 110 meters, 360 feet long, then divided along the median of each of those. These new settlements were initially pretty small. Cyrene in North Africa, for example, is supposed to have been populated by people brought in two ships called pentaconters, carrying at most a couple of hundred people, probably fewer. Within a generation or two, however, they were growing rapidly. The town plans I mentioned had to have been in place from an exceptionally early date in the settlement's life. And given the frequency with which land allotments and planning show up in the texts about foundations, they were probably present at the very beginning. This tells us some really important things about the nature of these colonies. Like I said, they were ambitious undertakings. They're often presented in the texts as initiatives sponsored by the home city in Greece, official expeditions, but most scholars working on these issues agree that this wasn't true in all or even most cases. Precisely what an official expedition even would have meant in the context of an 8th century BC Greek city with barely any actual political institutions is unclear. It's far more likely that private individuals, like losers in local political struggles or just plain ambitious folks, took the lead. In one case, an Oikist seems to have sought to create a little Sicilian empire for himself. The same man, Thucles, from Chalcis in Euboea, founded Naxos, then Leontinoi, then Catane, though the people of both Leontinoi and Catane soon decided on other leadership. These founders would have drawn on the knowledge of the Sicilian coastline accrued by at least two generations of Greek sailors and merchants, combined with whatever they had learned from Phoenician collaborators and rivals. The colonists, without fail, picked fantastic spots to build a new settlement that had to have been a product of advanced information and planning. Greek colonists built their new cities facing agricultural plains with excellent soil, river mouths, convenient landing spots, and harbors. Whatever the size of the initial group of settlers, they clearly had the future in mind when they planned things out, counting on future arrivals to bolster their numbers and fill out the cityscape. There was room for public buildings, temples, an agora or marketplace, even city walls, though those features might not actually appear for three or more generations. You might have noticed that I keep using the words ambitious and ambition, and it's hard not to apply it to these colonies. Not all of them worked out. The founders of Megara Hiblaea were on their third attempt to build a new city, the texts tell us, before they finally got it right. Others presumably disappeared without much of a trace. Think of all the ghost towns of the American West for a parallel, places that were inhabited for decades or a generation or two before they were abandoned. But the Greek settlements that did survive were pretty clearly built to last from the outset and were set up with an eye toward future growth. That's not something we can take for granted. As much as the differences between Phoenician and Greek colonization have blurred in recent years, this was still a significant difference. Phoenicians weren't looking for the same large agricultural hinterlands, there's much less evidence of really large-scale early planning, and the settlements didn't grow nearly as quickly. All of those substantial Greek colonies that were founded in the 8th century BC were joined by another round of fresh foundations from Greece in the 7th century BC. As the major settlements grew, exiles and ambitious people left them behind to found their own new colonies, sometimes close by and other times further away in Sicily. This process only reached an effective limit in the middle of the 6th century BC, 200 years after the process began. At that point, the Phoenicians and native Sicilians in the west and center of the island had clearly begun to take exception to Greek expansion. That was where it stopped, and the boundaries between ethnic groups in Sicily hardened and spilled over into major bouts of warfare and endemic violence. So these Greeks were ambitious, extraordinarily so. Why was that? Why were they so driven to create these new settlements, to spread out into the countryside to build not just little farms, but substantial agricultural enterprises, to eventually decorate their new cities with monumental temples and massive city walls? The land hunger I mentioned earlier really was at the heart of all this. That wasn't because the baby boom in 8th century BC Greece was causing the homeland to become overpopulated, at least not in the sense that resources were being stretched and quality of life was falling. Very much the opposite. So far as we can tell from the material record in Greece, markers of health and individual wealth were at least steady, if not getting better. But even with the extensive internal colonization in Greece itself, bringing land into use that had been effectively abandoned since Mycenaean times, not everybody could get their own slice of territory. That mattered not so much for subsistence as for citizenship, to mark a person and a family out as people who were included in the social and political fabric of their communities. This brings us back to the very beginning, the inseparability of what was happening in Greece and the development of overseas colonies. New cities with new political institutions and definitions of what being a person who mattered actually meant were coming into being. Not everybody who wanted to matter could, because if everybody mattered, then nobody did. So far as the evidence goes, it seems obvious that archaic Greek polis were incredibly competitive places. Prestige, land, and political power were all up for grabs both within and between families. It's not a coincidence that this was the environment that produced the Olympic Games, which began in 776 BC, along with a growing number of both local and regional athletic competitions. Some people were going to lose those competitions, athletic or deadly serious. When they did, they could either accept their lower status or they could go somewhere else. Sicily was right there. Land was plentiful. Remember, there were large tracts of barely occupied or unoccupied land right along the east coast of the island. Now, individually, none of those new settlements amounted to much, just a couple of hundred people scooped up from one or more parts of Greece under some would-be bigwigs' leadership. In the aggregate, however, the result was something much larger. Within a single generation, a whole budding network of new settlements had appeared along the eastern coast of Sicily. Within three generations, that little network had begun to subdivide into smaller ones, with each major settlement at the heart of its own little hierarchy. Within five generations, the Sicilian Greek cities weren't much less impressive than the polis in Greece itself, if they were at all. It's easy to think about these settlements in Greek terms from the Greek perspective as a product of Greek ambition and action, to give them all the agency in the matter. But let's remember Pithecusae. There's a good reason I started our discussion with it, not just because it was the earliest. The later Greek texts wrote out all the messiness of the process, reducing it to a clean foundation of virgin territory led by a defined person and a group of followers. There were already people living in Pithecusae when Greeks showed up there. Sicily had a great deal of available land, but who was going to work all that land? The historian Franco De Angelis, who wrote an excellent history of Greek Sicily, points out that in cases of land abundance, what's scarce is labor. The ambitious Greeks who wanted their own farms and to be citizens of their new apoikia, their home away from home, to be people who mattered in a new polis, well, they weren't going to handle all that grunt work themselves. Purchasing enslaved people could provide some of the muscle, but there were also already people living in Sicily. They could do the work, if not for compensation, then because they were forced to do so. In at least a few documented cases, conflict between Greeks and indigenous people in Sicily started immediately, and hunger for not just land but labor was part of that conflict. Over time, the locals were drawn more and more heavily into the Greek world, into its conceptions of labor, hierarchical relationships of power with the new arrivals. There was a lot of room for interaction, for really interesting cultural cross-fertilization and a middle ground of understanding. But that interaction didn't necessarily take place on equal terms. And Sicily was just one part of this emerging Greek world. New colonies were founded in southern Italy, North Africa, the Black Sea coast, and the western Mediterranean. By 500 BC, as many as half of all the Greek cities defined as polis weren't to be found in Greece itself, but overseas. And to the extent that there was an emerging sense of what it meant to be Greek, as opposed to a person from Corinth or Athens or any other cities, that Greekness was being forged not in Greece, but in these new homes away from home. Next time on Tides of History, we'll continue our exploration of archaic Greece, the emerging Greek world, and the Mediterranean. While colonies were being founded overseas, the new cities of the homeland were undergoing massive transformations of their own, with new ways of doing politics and making war taking hold and changing Greece forever.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I've also written a book called The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It's available now on hard copy, paperback, ebook, or audiobook from your distributor of choice. And there's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design by Molly Bach for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Laura Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.